After hours of delays and legal hand-wringing, the United States government conducted its first execution in 17 years this morning in Terre Haute. WFIU's Adam Pinsker was one of the media witnesses. As he reports, Daniel Lewis Lee continued to profess his innocence up until his final breath.
"You're killing an innocent man. I'm not perfect, but I'm not a murderer." Those were some of the final words spoken by Daniel Lewis Lee moments before a lethal dose of chemicals was administered into his body through three tubes that extended into the small execution chamber from behind a wall. The execution began at 7:47 a.m. Tuesday. Lee took several breaths and was officially pronounced dead at 8:06 a.m. At 2 a.m. Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court voted 5-4 to allow the execution to proceed. In 1999, Lee and an accomplice were convicted of robbing and killing William and Nancy Mueller, both gun salespeople, as well as murdering the couple's 8-year-old daughter. They stole $80,000 in guns, ammunition, and cash from the victims and drowned them in an Illinois bayou. Lee became the first inmate executed at the federal level since 2003. Two more men are scheduled to die in the next 3 days at the same prison, Wesley Ira Perkey on Wednesday and Dustin Lee Honkin on Friday.
For the second time in 48 hours, the Supreme Court rejected last-minute legal appeals, paving the way for another federal execution this week at the U.S. Penitentiary in Terre Haute. WFIU's Adam Pinsker tells us why this may not be the last federal execution under the Trump administration.
Moments before 68-year-old Wesley Ira Perkey was injected with a lethal dose of chemicals, he apologized to the family of Jennifer Long, the girl he was sentenced to death for raping and murdering in 1998. But Long's parents weren't in a forgiving mood.
"It didn't mean much to us. He's not very genuine.
I hope he wants some help. I really do.
He's a very manipulative individual."
Minutes before the execution began at 7:56 Eastern Time Thursday morning, the Supreme Court voted 5-4 to lift an injunction that would have ordered further mental evaluations of Perkey. Perkey was pronounced dead at 8:19 a.m. in the same gurney where Daniel Lee was executed early Tuesday morning. Outside the sprawling prison, Abe Bonowitz of the anti-capital punishment group Death Penalty Action told the crowd the executions are a way for President Trump to score cheap political points.
"George W. Bush, as president, only had 3 executions, and if Donald Trump can have 4, he will be the greatest."
Dustin Honkin is scheduled Friday to be the third inmate executed this week at the federal penitentiary. A fourth man, Keith Nelson, has an execution date of August 28th.
The Trump administration carried out its 9th federal execution of the year last night. Last-minute clemency pleas for Brandon Bernard were rejected. Celebrities and a former U.S. prosecutor had taken up his cause. George Hale from member station WFIU has more.
Fans flooded Donald Trump's Twitter account for a week after Kim Kardashian West asked for help trying to save Bernard's life. But late Thursday, it was the mother of a murdered youth minister applauding the president's decision to let the execution go forward.
"The family of Todd Bagley would like to thank President Donald J. Trump, Attorney General William H. Barr, and the Department of Justice."
Todd and his wife Stacy were visiting Texas in 1999 when a group of young men kidnapped them, hoping to empty their bank accounts. Hours later, the couple was locked in the trunk of their car when the gang's ringleader fatally shot them both. Bernard was a low-ranking member of the gang and followed orders to set the car on fire. Federal officials executed shooter Christopher Villalva in September. They also moved to set an execution date for Bernard. Supporters of Bernard insist he had no idea Villalva planned to shoot anyone. He was also only 18 at the time and wasn't part of the original kidnapping. But prosecutors managed to convince a mostly white jury to sentence both young black men to death. The majority of surviving jurors later changed their minds about Bernard. So did Angela Moore, a former U.S. prosecutor who helped defeat Bernard's appeal.
"Mr. Bernard was not planning on any kidnapping or killing to happen. Mr. Villalva was."
Moore wrote in an op-ed in the Indianapolis Star detailing her objections to Bernard's execution. That's when Kim Kardashian West got involved, tweeting the essay to her nearly 70 million followers. Trump listened to West before. He once hosted her.
"We were ending our day. It was almost time to leave or go home around 4 o'clock, if I recall."
Randy Strong is the sheriff of Nottoway County, which includes Skidmore and nearby Maryville, the county seat. In 2004, he was a police officer with the Maryville Police Department.
The report was the mother had come home, found her daughter who was pregnant on the floor, and it looked like her abdomen had exploded. And I thought, oh, this is not good. Skidmore is probably about a 15-minute drive from here. And so I waited around, lingered to see if Sheriff Espy would need some help, and sure enough, he called.
When Strong and Espy responded to a home at 410 Elm Street in Skidmore, they found the mutilated body of 23-year-old Bobby Joe Stinnett, who was 8 months pregnant at the time.
Probably one of the worst things I'd seen done to a human, maybe.
Police in Bloomington, Indiana, are searching for two people who were in a car that drove through a protest for racial justice last night. Two protesters were injured in the incident. Protesters were demanding justice for a black resident who they say was the victim of a racially motivated attack. The man's lawyer says the FBI is now investigating the incident as a hate crime. From member station WFIU, Mitch Legan reports.
Last night, hundreds of people gathered in downtown Bloomington to protest an assault on Vox Booker that occurred on July 4th. As protesters were crossing the street last night around 9:30, the driver of a red Toyota Camry appeared to get impatient with the crowd and hit the gas. Caleb Poor was there.
You know, we were expecting potentially people that might be bad actors to show up. I was just walking back to find my people, and I just heard tires, like, screech.
The protest was to draw attention to an apparent assault on local activist Vox Booker as he headed with friends to a nearby lake to watch the moon.
Rather than celebrate the holiday in the traditional way, some friends and I opted that we would have a gathering and watch the lunar eclipse. We were expecting to just have a fun, low-key night.
Booker says as he and his friends made their way to the lake, a group of white men claimed they were on private property and began harassing them. Booker says before he knew it, they were on top of him. Cell phone video shows at least four white men yelling racial epithets and pinning him against a tree as his friends plead with them to stop.
Let him go. Let him go, please.
They started yelling for the friends to get a noose.
Someone called 911 and dispatch sent Department of Natural Resources officers since they had jurisdiction over the area. Officers interviewed both groups, watched the cell phone video, and decided not to make arrests, saying they'd follow up with the county prosecutor's office. Now, some lawmakers have called on Governor Eric Holcomb to suspend those DNR officers pending further investigation. Booker spoke at last night's rally, saying it's time to start holding people accountable.
In that moment when five men were on top of me, and all I wanted to yell was I couldn't breathe, and I saw George Floyd's face in front of me, and all the ancestors that died having thinking that they couldn't breathe.
Bloomington police are still looking for the driver and the vehicle involved in last night's hit and run, and the county prosecutor's office hasn't given a timeline on whether it will bring charges against those assaulting Booker on July 4th.
Long-term care facilities across the state have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19. However, the extent to which facilities have been hit is largely unclear. WFIU's Brock Turner has more.
Since April, the state has been collecting COVID-19 information from long-term care facilities. We know the pandemic is more prevalent and deadly in older populations and people of color. However, Indiana is different in how it reports cases in its long-term care facilities to the public. All of Indiana's neighboring states and a growing number of other states are releasing facility-level data that sheds light on how COVID-19 is affecting specific long-term care facilities. Many Indiana counties are analyzing data themselves to inform decisions. Some have opted to make that public, while others have not. Multiple local health officials say they received direct guidance from the Indiana State Department of Health not to release facility-level data. That's something State Health Commissioner Dr. Christina Box and other senior officials deny.
To my knowledge, no one from the Indiana State Department of Health has ever directed anybody that they should not release their data. We have supported them releasing their data if they desired to release their data.
Days before, the state's Deputy Health Commissioner, Pam Pantones, gave talking points to local health officials not releasing facility-level data.
If you are asked why you aren't receiving facility-specific information, you can reference that you are following the communication guidelines for long-term care facilities located on the link at the slide.
The state encourages facilities to report directly to residents and their caregivers. Some messages sound like this.
Good afternoon. This is the COVID-19 update for today, May 12, 2020, for St. Anthony. Today, We have recorded 54 total nursing facility resident cases and one assisted living case for St. Anthony.
However, at least 22 complaints have been filed stating facilities have failed to communicate properly. The state's Joint Information Center says those complaints have been resolved or forwarded to the appropriate program area, but did not provide additional detail. Zach Cattell is the president of the Indiana Healthcare Association, a trade organization representing facilities across the state. He says long-term care operators have nothing to hide.
We understand the importance, but we want to make sure that what is reported is accurate, is comparable, so that it can be useful both for public health agencies and for individuals as they decide to choose to make a choice, rather, about what kind of skilled nursing facility or assisted living community to use.
For Stephanie Borum, releasing data is more than politics or written policy. She works in healthcare and is helping care for her father with Alzheimer's disease. Borum says she knew something was wrong when she noticed the man who spent his life coaching football and track becoming overwhelmed attending athletic events last year. But she says she's thankful the Hobart facility her dad lives in has been transparent and provides good care when she suspects others aren't receiving this type of care.
You're through a window and you can't do anything. I mean, but it is so good to feel we don't need to do anything, that he's well taken care of. But I think so many people go through that risk, and when they see their loved ones, you know, what if their clothing's on backwards and dirty, and they're dirty or not shaved or just unhappy?
She believes the data should be public, but says greater context is needed.
Information needs to be released, but I just wished everyone would understand what the numbers mean. And just because a facility decides not to test so their numbers look good doesn't mean there's nothing in there.
The context is important here. Facilities are required to report this data, but health experts say they have little incentive to do so. Further, the presence of COVID-19 in a facility is not necessarily representative of the care residents are receiving or will receive.
We have seen buildings that are five-star buildings have had outstanding records that have been devastated, frankly, by the virus and have had a large number of cases and have had people pass away, even have had staff members who have contracted the virus and passed away, and it's unbelievably heartbreaking. The regulatory record, past regulatory records, really don't have a bearing on what that virus is capable of doing and where it's going to reside.
According to the Indiana State Department of Health, more than 1,000 Hoosiers in long-term care facilities have died from COVID-19, and nearly 5,000 have been infected.
Could the coronavirus crisis lead to a housing crisis? The state's eviction moratorium is set to expire next Friday, so Governor Eric Holcomb announced a free settlement arbitration tool to try to keep eviction cases out of courts. Meanwhile, a Monroe County legal project has been trying to do the same on the county level. Mitch Legan reports.
When Kelson and Emily Burke moved into their rental house 2 years ago, they had found the perfect place to raise their family.
It was a dream come true. You know, we've always wanted a homestead, and the pandemic forced us to really buckle down and concentrate on our dream.
It's a house northeast of Bloomington, on a hill surrounded by tall pine trees, with enough space for four kids, a handful of ducks, and even a couple rabbits.
We've grown to have our full garden and birds here. Our homestead has blossomed and taken off, and we were supposed to be renewing our lease.
But a disagreement regarding the lease put the Burks in a position where their landlord wanted them out and filed for an emergency eviction to do so.
And with less than 30 days for us to figure out where we're going to go in Bloomington. In the Bloomington area, that's next to impossible.
The state's eviction moratorium only covers evictions for those who are unable to pay rent because of the pandemic. With some government assistance, the Burks have been able to keep up with their bills, so that meant the moratorium didn't apply to them. When they zoomed into their virtual court hearing, the Housing and Eviction Prevention Project of Monroe County stepped in. Comprised of nonprofit groups from around the area, the project started in 2019 as a way to reduce evictions and solve housing problems in the county.
And we thought it was time to look at this with kind of a multifaceted approach of bringing in social services and attorneys and mediators.
That's Judge Catherine Stafford, one of two judges who hear eviction cases in the county. A year after it started, the project has newfound importance. Although evictions for non-payment are on hold until at least next week, emergency eviction hearings like the Burks faced have continued. Mediators with the project were able to come to an agreement that extended the Burks' move-out date, and most importantly, kept an eviction off their record.
it was fantastic just to have them there. And without them there, we would not have come to this agreement. It was invaluable.
But with a week until the moratorium is set to expire, Governor Eric Holcomb announced the state will be setting up a free settlement arbitration tool for landlords and their tenants to try to keep eviction cases out of courts. What makes it even more difficult is that since landlords can't file evictions, it's tough to determine how many there might be. A June study from the Aspen Institute says around 20 million people across the country could be at risk of eviction by September. Over 24,000 Hoosiers have applied for the state's COVID rental assistance program, which led the governor to add an additional $15 million to the fund, for a total of $40 million. And the federal relief program that provided families with $600 to help with things like rent hasn't been extended.
I think they're a little patchwork. Obviously, if people can't pay their rent because they're not working, they're suddenly going to have the money to catch up $2,000 or $3,000 and pass rent. Seems a little bit like a pipe dream.
That was Jamie Sutton, the executive director of Justice Unlocked Legal Services. Monroe County Apartment Association President Mark Figg says his talks with landlords have not led him to expect a huge wave of evictions, but the lack of filing data makes it impossible to know.
I'll be honest, I don't have any idea. I mean, I'm assuming it's going to be up, but I have no evidence to support that.
For now, the governor says those who are struggling with payments need to work with their landlords on payment plans, something those with the eviction project have encouraged as well.
WFIU listeners continue to be gravely concerned about COVID-19. One listener recently asked our City Limits series, is the virus showing a consistently downward trend in Indiana? If not, why not? And if not, what must we do to achieve that? While daily positivity rates aren't as high as they were in April, when one day they reached 32%, that doesn't mark significant progress for Indiana in fighting the spread of COVID-19. WFIU's Benta Boutier reports.
One health data expert says comparing July and August's daily positivity rates to April's doesn't paint an accurate picture of Indiana's progress. That's because Indiana has dramatically increased its testing capabilities since then. Brian Dixon is the director of public health informatics at the Regan Streef Institute in Indianapolis.
Back in April, only people who were sick and in the hospital were getting tested. We were just starting to really build our test capacity. The positivity back then was so high because those people were sick and in the hospitals and they were more likely to have COVID-19.
He says the most important trends to follow are daily average positivity rates, actual numbers of cases, and 7-day average positivity rates.
So we can compare positivity from this week to last week or today to yesterday.
He says from the last week of June to mid-July, Indiana's positivity rates began to creep up.
We have not seen a consistent downward trend in COVID cases in Indiana. In fact, in July, what we saw was an increase in cases starting from the beginning of the month all the way through until the end of the month.
Toward the end of June and beginning of July, Indiana's 7-day average positivity rate sat between 4 and 6%, according to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center. By mid-July to mid-August, the 7-day average reached between 7 to 10%. Dixon says he feels cautiously optimistic about Indiana's progress moving forward, as rate increases seem to stabilize towards the end of July and beginning of August. But it's too early to tell if rates will remain that way or increase, as it can take test results anywhere from 2 days to 2 weeks to come back and count towards the state's data.
Our numbers are often a few days behind, if you will. So we really won't know the full picture for this week until we get kind of to the weekend.
He says July and August's increases can be attributed to relaxing stay-at-home orders. Indiana moved to stage 4 of Governor Eric Holcomb.
Within the next decade, 9 coal plants in Indiana are expected to close or partially shut down. While that may mean cleaner air, it can also have repercussions for the towns that host these plants. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel tells us how the partial closure of a plant in rural southern Indiana will affect the people who live there and how they're working to adapt.
In Petersburg, Indianapolis Power and Light is everywhere.
You can see its logo on everything from the high school scoreboard to an Adopt a Highway sign. Almost everyone who lives in the town of less than 3,000 seems to be connected to the plant in one way or another. Tara Mullis is no exception. She owns the Caddyshack Restaurant, a small home-style diner made out of her grandparents' old storage barn. Locals come in and out to pick up styrofoam takeout boxes, piling up behind the counter. Mullis says about half her customers work at the coal plant. IPL expects to lay off more than 100 workers when it closes down 2 of 4 coal units there in 2023.
That makes up a lot of our community, and you know, if they're not bringing in income, then they're not spending income either. So, yeah, it's worrisome.
But what really worries Mullis is what will happen if the plant ever shuts down completely. Her husband is a coal miner, and the plant purchases Indiana coal. It's not just plant workers and businesses that stand to suffer from the partial closure, however. Schools could also take a hit.
Who's that, guys?
IPL is Pike County's largest taxpayer, and a little less than half of those taxes go to the district. Pike County Schools Superintendent Suzanne Blake says when the utility shifted some of its assets away from the Petersburg plant last year, the district had to close its smallest elementary school. She says the school corporation also gets about $6,000 per student.
If we don't reestablish either industry or business or a reason to draw families to this community, then they're going to locate elsewhere.
Attracting new businesses has been top of mind for Ashley Willis. She's the executive director for the Pike County Economic Development Corporation. Willis says the county has made some sites shovel-ready for industrial companies and helped fund a technology center. It also recently welcomed a new solar farm, which Willis expects will offset a third of the revenue that was lost last year.
Trying to get the next industries in here so that, you know, we're not playing catch-up and we don't fall behind. We want to transform and evolve as the trends do.
Blake says Pike County Schools is also doing what it can to attract industry by teaching the next generation of workers technical skills while they're still in high school. Kevin Carter teaches welding to juniors and seniors from 5 high schools in the area. The classes are popular. There are more than 30 students enrolled this year. Wearing protective helmets, they join pieces of metal together with torches inside individual booths. Then they come out to sand their work and get a critique.
Pattern's not perfect, but width looks good.
Carter says a lot of kids in Pike County grow up wanting to work at the coal plant. It's been seen as a high-paying, reliable job. He hopes his classes will open up multiple job opportunities for his students.
I mean, a skilled trade you can take and parlay into a lot of other jobs. I mean, you might be a welder at a coal mine or a power plant, but you could also maybe manufacture or do welding at a Toyota or some other manufacturing facilities.
That idea appeals to senior Hunter Russell, who wants to be a mechanical engineer.
Once I get to college, I've thought maybe traveling around a little bit, but I'm always probably going to be a homebody. I like it around here.
Though the Petersburg coal plant will have a partial shutdown in 3 years, IPL hasn't set a date to retire the plant completely. While the state works to figure out how Indiana should transition away from coal, locals hope they'll have enough time to make sure this small city doesn't turn into a ghost town.
On January 1st, Illinois legalized the sale of recreational pot. Shops can't keep up with demand, and some have had to close while they replenish their supply. And in Michigan, it's only been legal a few weeks, and the story there is the same. Sales are already well into the millions of dollars. As the tides shift and more states allow the drug, advocates are hoping Indiana lawmakers will get on board. WFIU's Brock Turner brings us the first of 2 reports on marijuana legalization and the pressure Indiana is facing to change its stance on cannabis.
Legalization of marijuana.
As lawmakers arrived Monday for the first day of the 2020 legislative session, about 50 people holding signs, smoking joints, and chanting greeted them on the steps of the Indiana State House.
We've got advocates all over the state who have stepped up at this point, and they are ready for action. They are going to take action in their communities. They're going to visit their town councils. They're going to visit their county councils. And they're going to deliver a united message that this needs to be taken care of.
Despite the recent changes in neighboring Illinois and Michigan, Hoosier lawmakers aren't keen on putting legalized marijuana up for a vote. For years, Senator Karen Tallien has authored bills that would loosen Indiana's marijuana restrictions, but they've never gained any traction.
In 2018, there were 22,000 arrests in Indiana for marijuana possession. It's the second most arrested crime in the state of Indiana, and it needs to stop.
Tallien joined the statehouse protesters to call on Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb to advance the conversation. Pressure from those in the governor's own party is growing as well. Jim Lucas is a representative for portions of four southern Indiana counties in the state's House of Representatives.
When I first started this conversation years ago, it was stigma and ignorance were the two biggest obstacles. But now stigma is something that's almost gone because 33 states have a medical cannabis program. I believe there are 11 now with recreational, two border states for Indiana.
Lucas is a Republican and one of the loudest voices in the GOP calling on legislators to develop a cannabis program. He believes neighboring states coming on board creates pressure for Indiana.
This is something we're going to be forced to deal with. But again, now it makes no sense to not be having this conversation. Because the facts, the research, everything is out there. All somebody has to do is just, educate themselves.
Holcomb, however, says he won't be influenced by what other states do.
So, no, other states don't persuade me.
Have you ever used marijuana?
Yes.
Even though it's illegal?
Yes.
When did you use it?
College.
And an influential organization in Indiana politics says changes in neighboring states won't impact their efforts either. Zach Ostowski is the public information officer at the Indiana Prosecuting Attorney's Council.
And that's what we're kind of trying to stress to people in Indiana who think, okay, maybe I can go across the border and buy it and bring it back. It's still going to be illegal in Indiana. It's still going to be charged by the prosecutors here in Indiana. Again, until something changes in Indiana, that's not going to affect our stance what other states are doing.
Holcomb and other GOP leaders have said they're not interested in exploring legalization in Indiana until the federal government declassifies marijuana as a controlled substance. Federally, cannabis is considered a Schedule I drug without medical benefits. Lucas disagrees with that line of thinking.
Leaders need to lead, and this is something I'd like to see our leadership get out in front of and just stay out of the way. Let the process happen. Let us have that conversation. Let the committee hearings take place. Let's get all parties, the pros and the cons, at the table and let the people hear, what is possible for the state of Indiana that 33 other states are doing.
The governor's office says his stance on marijuana legalization has not changed, and his office declined to comment on the assertion from those in favor of legalization that he's limiting the conversation.
The 2020 legislative session wrapped up in Thursday's early morning hours. It was a session led by major health care and education measures, but WFIU's Brandon Smith reports the session was also marked by something else. How unusual it was.
The word used by many throughout 2020 to describe the legislative session? Weird. From lawmakers to staffers to lobbyists, even the House and Senate doorkeepers, it kept coming up. Why? Well, let's look at the House Public Policy Committee. That's a major committee, typically responsible for handling issues like guns, abortion, alcohol, gambling, and Chair Ben Smaltz didn't hold a single meeting in this non-budget short session.
We should be dealing with emergencies and not things that don't rise to that level.
Now, there was an abortion bill this session, but unlike just about every year for the last decade, there wasn't as much controversy around it. It even earned yes votes from Democrats who traditionally vote against such measures. Republican Senator Liz Brown sheds a little light on why.
Let me tell you what this bill doesn't do. It doesn't put any burden or any additional costs on the woman who is choosing to have an abortion.
Maybe the session was weird because of how quickly it went by. That's something Speaker Brian Bosman noticed early on.
Well, these were the two fastest start of session weeks that I've experienced in my 34 years here.
Case in point, Governor Eric Holcomb signed the first bill of 2020 into law before the session had even hit its halfway point, which is very rare. Now, that bill spends extra surplus dollars from the state budget that closed last summer. Republicans say they passed it fast to get the money out. House Democratic leader Phil Giaquinta thinks there's another reason.
The quicker you can get that off the calendar means you don't have to deal with it or talk about it anymore, so I'm sure that's part of the strategy.
Still, there were big bills that received broad bipartisan support, measures to loosen regulations on public schools and shield teachers from penalties over low student test scores. There was also consensus on the need to make health care costs lower and more transparent. There's disagreement, however, over whether that was accomplished this session. Here's Democrat Robin Shackelford.
When you have a constituent that has a deductible that's $2,500, $5,000, when we get out this session, nothing is going to change for them.
And here's Republican Speaker Todd Houston.
Really, we've allowed a level of transparency for both employers and, most importantly, patients that we've never seen before. And, you know, we all have to be, and we all should be, better consumers of health care.
I just called him Speaker Todd Houston after referring earlier to Speaker Brian Bosma. Well, that's another weird element to the 2020 session. The leader of the House changed during it. Bosma announced that move early on.
At the end of this session, I will be stepping down from the speakership and won't be running for re-election.
Bosma is the longest-serving House Speaker in state history, and Houston, who was tabbed months ago to succeed him, worked alongside Bosma throughout the session.
You know, I couldn't imagine walking in here without this type of transition, so I'm very, very grateful to Speaker Bosma for it, and I'm still going to make a bunch of mistakes, and I totally acknowledge that, but I hope it'll at least limit them.
Both chambers have undergone a complete turnover of leadership over the last 14 months, and lobbyist Mike O'Brien says the people who work in and around the legislature, as he has for 20 years, have noticed. He describes a disconnect between leaders and committees which makes the process suffer.
Those of us who have been doing this for a long time have kind of joked, you know, either look back at this session and say, boy, that was weird, or this is just how we're doing it from now on. It's just going to be a little chaotic.
Weird indeed.
Barring a last-minute curveball from the federal courts, Indiana will be one of only four states without expanded vote by mail for the 2020 general election amid an ongoing pandemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on how the state got to this point and where it might go from here.
Governor Eric Holcomb declared a public health emergency over COVID-19 on March 6th. 2 weeks later, before he issued an expansive stay-at-home order, Holcomb postponed the primary election from May to June. And the Indiana Election Commission expanded the state's vote-by-mail system, allowing any eligible voter to cast their ballot that way for the primary. That was done in agreement with the Indiana Republican and Democratic Party leaders and Secretary of State Connie Lawson.
All of these steps will be in concert to ensure that our election process will continue and that every eligible voter is given the opportunity to vote.
People took advantage. More Hoosiers voted absentee than on Election Day. A few months later, things have changed.
We are going forward with a normal election process here in Indiana. We will not be making changes like we did in the primary since the stay-at-home order has been lifted.
There are about a dozen reasons you can still legally vote by mail, including if you're 65 or older, if you're working or will be absent from your county the entire time polls are open on Election Day, or if you're confined to your home. But despite repeated calls, a vote at the Indiana Election Commission, and a lawsuit, Republican leaders have refused to expand the system for the general election. They argue with so many people back to work and going out in public, there's no need for more mail-in options. And they insist in-person voting is safe. Governor Holcomb also suggests another reason.
We also deserve to have a very timely election results. We call it election day, not election month.
Indiana Democratic Party Chair John Zodi doesn't buy it. He says it's purely political hypocrisy.
I think there's been a terrible dereliction of duty by the state administration and all those Republicans who claim to be patriots and advocates for the right to vote when they are basically suppressing it as we speak.
If there are political calculations behind Republicans' decision not to expand vote by mail, political scientist Laura Wilson says those calculations don't make much sense.
Other states do have mail-in voting entirely. So we've been able to look at those states and confirm, in fact, it does not benefit any party over another. Both parties have their own demographics that would benefit in their own way from mail-in voting.
And there are Hoosier Republicans fighting to expand it, including with the advocacy group Indiana Vote by Mail. It's headed by Barbara Tully, who is part of the fight this year, sued the state, so far unsuccessfully, to force it to expand mail-in voting this fall. But Tully says the change she really wants isn't temporary, it's permanent.
Indiana has very low voter turnout rates when you rank us amongst all 50 states, and we need to do something to improve that. Vote by mail as an option for voters to use if they choose to brings more people into the electoral process.
Tully says her organization will push the General Assembly to expand vote by mail when it reconvenes in 2021. Laura Wilson says the spotlight on mail-in voting this year could help that cause.
Because I think a lot of people will say, but really, why don't we have it? It brings to the forefront the challenges we have with the current system. And individuals who may not have cared about it otherwise, may not have used it otherwise, it may not have applied to them otherwise. Certainly everything about this year is different, and that's true for the election cycle as well. It might get them thinking about it in a different way.
The Indiana Senate easily passed a bill to expand vote by mail just 2 years ago, but that measure, sponsored by a Republican, died without a vote in the House.
The Big Ten postponed football this fall due to the pandemic, but a big part of Indiana University's game day isn't sitting on the sidelines. As WFIU's Joe Wren reports, Indiana's marching band hasn't stopped, but adapted to the new normal.
The parking lot at Indiana University's Memorial Stadium isn't supposed to be empty this time of year. There's no tailgating or smoke wafting from grills. No fans in red and white throwing footballs waiting for kickoff. Traditions like the walk will have to wait a few more weeks. Instead, COVID-19 testing signs point to IU's mitigation site inside the stadium. But on a weekday afternoon, a familiar game day sound might get your attention. The IU's Marching 100 is still practicing in its usual outdoor lot, providing a little relief to this year's somber reality.
1 minute, and then you'll be swapping roles. If you are marching, you'll be playing. And if you are playing, you will be marching.
IU senior drum major Jacob Kessler says being around other band members is a big motivator. He says many haven't been able to play their instruments with other people since March.
It's completely different to be surrounded by your best friends or new people, the freshmen, the rookies, that you've never been able to talk to before and just socialized and do something you love.
Kessler says the staff spent the summer researching the science behind aerosols, and the band feels safe practicing outside. There's an online version of rehearsals too, but so far no one has opted out from meeting in person. Eric Smedley is in his first year directing the band.
If you go around campus, there's not a whole lot going on. And, you know, we thought, well, we can help with that.
The Marching 100 is a no-contact sport of sorts, even though it's not part of the athletic department. Students get tested just like everyone else on campus. Band members wear masks with small slits for instrument mouthpieces.
And there's this kind of an inherent discipline to it, right? I mean, they know they have to stand in this spot and they don't move around. You know, it's easier to control that amount of people in a marching band setting.
And the instruments have masks too. IU adorned bell covers are new this year. Smedley has also had to figure out how to conduct rehearsals with 275 band members when the county's health department is limiting the outdoor gathering sizes to 150.
We're just never all doing something at the same time. You know, the most will be that 150, and even then I've got them spread out 6.5 feet side to side and double that front to back.
The biggest change is showtime. The band won't march and play at the same time. That's to keep each other's aerosol paths from crossing. Associate instructor Daniel Johnson says the music and marching will be recorded separately and edited together for the stadium big screen, and some pieces will be shared on social media.
We're going to record pregame like you would see at a football game, and we're also going to record 3 halftime shows. And also we're going to do a couple of concerts around campus.
It's mixed emotions for band members who are trying to meet their mental health and academic needs.
Indiana's out, three mouths, deep breaths.
Senior year Mellophone staff member Lisa Carey says she feels safe, and for someone who was training to be a high school band director, the pandemic has created quite a learning experience.
I think it's this year shifting the focus to, no, it's about community health, it's about preserving our health, things of that nature. I think that's the biggest shift for me.
Johnson says it's a change for the staff too.
It's been different, but the great thing about this is it's a new challenge. You know, it's a new challenge, one that I don't think anyone as a teacher could have foreseen in their teaching career.
The band is working on the pregame show and started practicing music for the first halftime show this week. Ain't No Mountain High Enough, I'm Still Standing, and We Found Love. They plan to perform through November.
Good morning. This is regional news coverage from the WFIU newsroom. I'm Sarah Whitmire. Black Lives Matter protests continued in Indianapolis last night for the fifth night, and they ended peacefully without police confrontation. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports that's despite many protesters marching well past a mandatory 9 p.m. curfew.
From mid-afternoon until about 10 p.m., two peaceful demonstrations started at Monument Circle and wound around downtown. Protesters and police encountered each other on the steps of the State House, but there was no violence on either side. As protesters continued to march past the curfew, police waited at intersections but purposefully did not block or arrest protesters. Elder Coleman led the crowd in chants several times. He says they want to see increased training and better policing of black communities.
But we also want officers who have unjustly murdered and executed persons to be arrested.
Demonstrators say they'll return each night until they see meaningful change in police policies. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
Democrat Joe Biden and Republican Donald Trump have won Indiana's presidential primary. The Democratic result in Indiana was expected because Biden's rivals have already dropped out of the race. The former vice president's Hall of Delegates from the Indiana victory pushes him closer to the 1,911 delegates he needs to capture the Democratic presidential nomination. The state's primary was delayed by 4 weeks because of the coronavirus outbreak. The Secretary of State says Hoosiers should not expect full final results from yesterday's primary for at least a few more days. That's because of all the absentee ballots that were cast in this election. Another 430,000 Hoosiers have been diagnosed with COVID-19. That raises Indiana's total confirmed cases to more than 35,000. A total of more than 2,000 Hoosiers have died from COVID-19 1 month after Indiana began reopening businesses. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lauren Chapman reports state officials say their analysis of the data still supports reopening.
The state reached another grim milestone, more than 2,000 confirmed dead just more than a month after reaching 1,000. State Health Commissioner Chris Bach says it's hard to describe the number.
If you had asked me 10 weeks or 12 weeks ago that we'd be sitting here with this many Hoosiers who have lost their lives from this particular disease, I think I would have had trouble understanding that. It's been the hardest part of this job, quite honestly.
But she says with the state's ability to care for COVID-19 patients holding steady and no vaccine or treatment on the horizon, officials had to decide how to reopen. The death toll is likely higher than the confirmed number. There are an additional 175 probable deaths where no test was administered, but healthcare professionals believe the person had the virus. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lauren Chapman.
Eli Lilly and Company has begun what it calls the first study in the world for a potential COVID-19 antibody treatment for humans. The phase 1 patients were given their first dose and will be observed with initial results in about 1 month. While medications currently on the market have been repurposed to fight COVID-19, Lilly's chief scientific officer Daniel Skovronsky says this new treatment is specifically focused on treating the virus and used a survivor's blood to develop it.
Together with our collaborator, Abcellera, we were able to obtain a specimen of their blood and look across millions of cells in their blood to find hundreds and hundreds of antibodies against COVID-19 that this patient had made to help them fight off the infection.
Skrivinsky says pending results, the next step would be to test the treatment on people outside of hospitals. If the drug shows positive results, doses could be available to the public by the end of the year. For WFIU News, I'm Sarah Whitmire.